Now we thought it would be nice to move from this conversation about whether black marriage is on the rocks or not to advice about how to keep any marriage healthy. Now, there are any number of people who want to give advice on marriage, but we decided to call on Cynthia Bond Hobson and Roger Hobson because they've been happily married for 35 years. They have 2 children and 4 grandchildren, but they are also people who've done all this while practicing 2 professions that are sometimes very hard on relationships, journalism and ministry. And probably because of that, they decided they wanted to do more than just celebrate their own happy union. They want to help other couples experience that same joy. So they wrote a book together that spills some common sense and surprising tips for keeping that newlywed glow for decades into your marriage. It's called I Do Every Day, Words of Wisdom for Newlyweds and Not So Newlyweds. And Roger Hobson, he is the Reverend Roger Hobson, by the way, and Cynthia Bond Hobson join us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us here.
I did want to start by just asking you about the conversation that we just had about the way marriage, particularly black marriage, is sort of portrayed in the media. And I wanted to ask if any of that resonates with you. Our guest specifically feels that he thinks that there's kind of a negative narrative around black marriage, and he just doesn't think that that's warranted. I wanted to ask if you share that thought or not.
I think he's correct. Growing up, I saw bad marriages and good marriages, but the greater number were good marriages. And I think with us as African Americans, it's like we don't brag ourselves about the good marriages. It's the ones that don't last long that get all the media attention.
I think the ones that are lethal get a whole lot more play than the ones that are positive. I'm thinking about Cliff and Claire Huxtable. They really loved and cared about each other, and they got along. And since the Cosby Show went off the air, I don't think we've had that many other images that are kind of like that, that said, yes, they have careers, they have children who are not in prison. And I just think the images are lopsided, if anything.
Well, there are the Obamas.
I love them.
Well,
when he looks at her, I mean, you know that this man is in love with this woman, and no matter whatever else comes, that's not going to change. And so, yes, absolutely, Michelle and Barack Obama are an important role model for African-American women and men, and particularly for black marriage.
But to that end, though, is that in part what you were hoping to accomplish with this book, to let people know that a happy marriage over time is possible and also how to do it? I guess what I'm asking is, in part, you want to be role models for people, even if people don't know you.
Absolutely.
I think one of my main goals is to help men understand they need to talk, to communicate. You know, I don't think we're socialized to give ourselves to talk much and to let our feelings come out. It's almost like we have to be guarded. And I think a lot of racism and the things that happen in the world cause us to be guarded and to show that strong image. But there's times to be tough and there are times to be tender. And you have to know the difference.
How did you learn that for yourself?
I grew up, my mother, she cleaned houses, and my father worked in a cleaner's. And my father was pretty distant and cold, but my grandfather was as affectionate. He would give you a hug and a kiss, but when he needed to be firm in business or whatever, he knew how to be firm. And so I decided that I kind of liked my grandfather's image of being strong, but knowing, being able to say to other men, I love you, I care about you. And I didn't like my father's image, who was just a strong man who just couldn't give himself.
Professor Hobson, I'll ask you, what about women? What are some of the things you think that women could do to help their marriages?
Stop expecting people to read their minds. If you need some quiet time, if you need some space, you need to say that you shouldn't expect people to read your mind. You will have to work at that. And that's one of the challenges for us. We work in everything else, but we don't work at our marriages. I went to this workshop, and the couple said, you know, how many hours did you work at your job? How many hours did you do this or that or the other? And I'm thinking, well, what did that have to do with anything? And then they asked, how many hours did you work on your marriage last week? And I thought, oh, I'm supposed to work on my marriage? So it was at that point that I realized that I had to fix myself up and not let myself go, so that he would be much more interested in the woman down the street than he would be in the woman who's at his home. And so taking care of yourself, both physically and mentally, You know, there's so many things that we can do to be supportive of one another.
Reverend Hobson, can I ask you this question? It might be a sensitive question. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're talking about a new guide for keeping a happy marriage. It's called I Do Every Day. I'm speaking with the co-authors. They are the husband and wife team, Roger Hobson. He's the Reverend Hobson. And Cynthia Bond Hobson. She's also Professor Hobson. And Reverend Hobson, I'm interested in this question of why should people get married?
It's more than just government regulations. It's that we're part of each other. We've given ourselves to each other. You can live together and make that same commitment, but it is so easy. I think it's so subconsciously, it's so easy to get your stuff, take your ball and bet, and go home.
And you think partly marriage is the way that you signal your intention.
Yes.
To
right.
do the hard thing. Well, Professor right. Hobson, I'm going to ask you this question. I think there are some women who might say that part of the reason they might not be as interested in marriage is that they like the freedom, the autonomy, and they don't like the fact that traditionally marriage has meant a sort of subservient role for women where they are expected to kind of put their interests and desires aside, and they just don't want to. And what would you say to women who feel, well, you know, I don't need all that?
I would want to say that if you structure your marriage according to, I think, what God intends, then you have all the things that you need. You need the freedom, but you also have that freedom if you and your husband or your wife talk about what it is that you need. You have that somebody who encourages you and allows you the space to grow.
Is there one piece of advice that you wish each of you had been given before you got married that you want to be sure you pass on? And Reverend Hobson, I'll ask you first. And then Cynthia, I'll give you the last word.
The first year of my marriage was pretty tough because I wanted to do it in a manly fashion and I wanted to be in control. And fortunately, there were people around me who said, the image of marriage that you're looking for is not a dominating kind of thing. It's a partnership. And so I appreciate that.
And Professor Hobson, what about you? Is there one piece of advice you wish someone had told you before you got married?
You don't have to say everything that's on your mind. And certainly that you can choose to be happy. And I thank and praise the Lord for sending me a husband that I can love and admire. And I know that liking him is every bit as important as loving him. So,
Cynthia Bond Hobson and Roger Hobson are co-authors of the book I Do Every Day, Words of Wisdom for Newlyweds and Not So Newlyweds. And they were kind enough to join us from Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Major League Baseball's playoff contenders are slugging their way to the World Series while the NBA season is in jeopardy due to a labor dispute. But commentator Frank DeFord says none of that matters because here in America, there's really only one sport.
Football is real big. Everybody knows that. But it is getting bigger. Football is now gigantic, monstrous, humongous. Sure, it was years ago that it passed baseball as our most popular sport, but by now football simply looms alone above the American sportscape. I would rank the U.S. sports entities this way. Number one, the NFL. Number two, college football. Three, fantasy football. Four, Major League Baseball. Five, high school football. Six, the NBA. Oh, the first 2 weeks of the NBA season have been canceled because of a labor dispute? And maybe the whole season is in jeopardy? But have you heard much weeping and wailing about that? No, hey, we got our football. Any run-of-the-mill NFL game scores ratings numbers above what baseball, the erstwhile national pastime, does with its championships. We can't get enough football. Why, I think you can make the argument now that the NFL draft, a bunch of guys reading off names in a ballroom, is the premier American sporting event of the spring. No, American football never will be as dominant as soccer stands supreme in so many countries. Baseball, basketball, and ice hockey, too, maintain large and passionate fandoms here. But what has changed is that now we don't have four major team sports. We have football, uber alles, and three other subsidiary popular games. Football's hegemony was established because it plays so well on TV and is, with the point spread, such a perfect game to bet. Its recent upsurge, I believe, can be accounted for by the fantastic popularity of fantasy football and by the fact that football's bang-bang moving violence meshes so perfectly with the video games that young men love. Baseball is a game of hand-eye coordination and exercise in craft. And when it rained, we were a nation that built things. In movies, then, heroes nimbly rode horses and sophisticated private eyes figured stuff out. Football is, by comparison, a muscle leg game. In concert today on movie screens, speed and car crashes rule. We must always be very careful in trying to relate any country's taste in sport to its national temperament. After all, the most varied of cultures all prefer soccer. But still, America's increased devotion to football must mean something. Unlike our two other homebred sports, baseball and basketball, which have developed appeal in many other countries, American football is just that, American, that we alone love this sport so much and love it more and more. That must tell us something about ourselves.
Frank DeFord tells us something about ourselves each Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This week we're exploring the lives of Latinos in the United States in our series Two Languages, Many Voices. In a moment, we'll talk about the economic and educational progress of Mexican Americans, who make up the largest group of Latinos in this country.
But first, you may have heard about the digital divide, people who have access to smartphones and broadband internet, and those who don't. But there's another digital divide, and that's between those in the U.S. who speak English and those who don't. As Alex Schmidt reports, kids are the ones bridging the digital language divide.
On a weekend in East L.A., kids do what they do anywhere else: play games, hang out in restaurants. But in this immigrant neighborhood, many of them have grown-up responsibilities. 15-year-old Gonzalo Cruz says his parents depend on him for help online.
When they need it, like, to look up a place, like a considered place, a doctor's appointment, like I show them. Computers right now in our country, like they're just English. You gotta learn, like, you have to learn how to use them a specific way.
13-year-old Cassandra Flores helps her parents pay bills online.
Yeah, a lot of kids from school do the same thing. So it feels a really important role to play, because you're helping your parents with a lot of work and stressing out of understanding.
Of course, it's not unusual for younger generations to help adults with strange and challenging new technology. But when you add in the language barrier, that help becomes a crucial family responsibility. Vicky Katz is at Rutgers University and has studied the way immigrant kids help their parents with technology.
A lot of the resources that immigrant families need the most are online, and sometimes they are only online.
Like visa forms and school applications, and important everyday things too, like finding a local business. So say I'm a Spanish speaker in Los Angeles and I want to find an orthopedist. I go to google.com and type in Oficina Ortopedista Los Angeles. The top result I get is in Madrid.
There's no excuse for us not doing a better job with this.
Tristan Upstill is an engineer at Google. He says this is a problem all over the world. There are lots of Turkish speakers in Germany, for example, who have a hard time finding what they need. But right now, if you search in Spanish, it's difficult for Google to guess that you want an orthopedist in the U.S. Upstill says to determine that, Google needs to deal with mind-bogglingly high numbers of combinations.
Well, it's quite clear that you have to build very scalable algorithms to not just deal with native language speakers in a particular country. So it's a difficult problem, and we're always looking at how we can do a better job here.
Hola, señora, ¿cómo está? No.
For now, it falls to bilingual kids to pick up the slack.
En el 95, Messi...
It's Saturday at the Perez household near Los Angeles. Today, Pedro has asked his 18-year-old son to look up info on the soccer player Lionel Messi. Pedro looks over Victor's shoulder as Victor reads aloud from his smartphone. Victor helps his dad and mom, Violeta, with everything online, from finding job forms to local stores and news.
Victor me ayudaba prácticamente cuando necesitamos saber algo en el internet que no nosotros no lo podemos hacer, él no lo busca.
When we need to see something in the internet, Violeta says, he finds it. When we go somewhere, he finds the directions. When we have to go to work, we have to get there fast. He also helps us with the business with the house that we rent. It can be a lot of responsibility for a teenager. But helping out online is just an extension of what immigrant kids have long done. Recently, Victor was on his way to a party when his mom received some important information about their home.
So I had to take her to the lawyer that's handling what we had to do, and I just didn't go. So,
were you upset, or were you like, that's just the way it is, and this is what I do?
Well, I have to care for my parents, because if we don't have a house, where will we live? So I stayed with her. I didn't really mind, because our family is more important than a party. So,
Victor's parents have internet in their home, and they can afford computers. But until they can use those devices the same way English speakers can, kids like Victor will be closing the language divide and the digital divide, too. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When it comes to the future of human life on Earth, there's no more basic question than, will there be enough food for everybody? Well, a group of scientists just took a fresh look at that question, and their conclusions are both comforting and disturbing. NPR's Dan Charles, with our Planet Money team, has this report.
Before Jonathan Foley became an expert on global food production at the University of Minnesota, he was an astronomer.
So, you know, take an astronomer and have him think about farming, this is what you get.
What you get is a look at farming on the whole planet, as if you were staring at Earth from outer space. When you do that, the thing that jumps out at you, Foley says, is this. Pretty much the single most destructive thing that we humans do to our planet is grow food.
Agriculture and our croplands and pastures uses up 40% of all the land on Earth. It's 70% of the water being consumed on the planet. It's about a third of all the greenhouse gas emissions.
That's shocking. A third of all greenhouse gases, you say, are coming from farming?
Conservatively a third, probably more.
And then you realize it's going to get worse. Another 2 or 3 billion people are coming. Plus, a lot of people are getting richer, which means they eat more. And they eat more meat, which in turn means you have to grow even more crops to feed those animals.
It turns out that we would have to double the world's food supply by 2050 to keep up with that demand.
Double the world's food supply.
That's right. What it took 10,000 years to build up to, we have to double in the next 40 years or less.
Foley and a group of collaborators from around the world took a close look at whether this is even possible. In a study released today by the scientific journal Nature, they say it is, if we do 5 things. First, stop cutting down forests to grow crops. Second, instead of that, focus on land that's already being used to grow food but isn't very productive.
Eastern Europe, for example, is not producing much food right now, but it could. Much of Africa could be growing much more food than it is today.
An average acre of land in Africa currently produces only about a sixth as much grain as an acre in Illinois. Third, use water more efficiently, also fertilizer. Fourth, in rich countries, don't throw away so much food. In poor countries, keep it from spoiling before it gets to the people who need it. Fifth, and this may be the most controversial thing in this paper, eat less meat. Right now, a third of all crops in the world go to feed cattle, chickens, and pigs. If we do all that, Foley says, there will be enough food for everybody, and we won't have to destroy even more of our planet. But we really need to do all that.
It is impossible to keep feeding the world the way we are and do it sustainably. You know, if we're going to feed the world and sustain the environment, we have to get on this path.
Now, Foley gave a presentation on this topic recently to an academic audience. And Thomas Hertel from Purdue University got up and said, basically,
what about economics?
Hertel says the problem with this paper is it doesn't really show us how to get on this different path.
It's all well and good to tell people they shouldn't consume meat, but in the end, consumer preferences will prevail. And that's what's driving the increased production of some of the feed grains.
Farmers all over the world grow whatever earns them the most money. Hertel says economic forces created the kind of farming we have today, and the trick will be to use those same economic forces to help change it. For instance, taxes or regulations can make it really expensive to clear forests for agriculture or to overdose fields with fertilizer. But when it comes to figuring out how to grow enough food for everybody or decide how much grain gets fed to animals instead of directly to people, it's still going to come down to markets, he says, supply and demand. When food gets scarce, prices do rise, and farmers respond by growing more. Also, they'll be motivated to do a couple of things on Foley's list: get more productive and more efficient. Dan Charles, NPR News.
And there are more kids like Victor than ever before because the Hispanic population is now growing more because of births than immigration, which means there are now more children of Hispanic immigrants in the U.S. than immigrants.
That should translate into more progress educationally and economically because historically, each new generation does better than the first. Historically, but not always.
Our next guest, Steve Trejo, is an economist at the University of Texas at Austin, where he's looked closely at Mexican Americans, the largest group of Latinos in this country. He's found that the third generation of Mexican Americans hasn't fared as well as would be expected.
The puzzle to me is that if you look at the U.S.-born children, the second generation of current U.S. immigrant groups, all these other groups, Asian groups and white groups, by the second generation, they've caught up with third and higher generation whites in terms of earnings, in terms of education. The outliers, the groups that that isn't the case for, are Mexicans, Dominicans, Central Americans.
Well, then, how do you account for the lag?
What I can tell you is that Mexican immigrants arrive with, on average, about 9 years of schooling. If we look at the U.S.-born children of Mexican immigrants, when they grow up, you know, they have over 12 years of schooling. So that's a lot of progress between those two generations. But then average education levels don't really go up very much for third and higher generation Mexicans compared to second generation Mexicans. So I think there is some progress there. I just think Mexicans are starting from a lower level and it's going to take a little longer.
What about geographic differences within the U.S.? Are Mexican Americans more likely to advance in their careers and also in their education levels in cities, say, on the East Coast or in the Midwest than they would in border states like Texas and California?
Yeah, no, it's certainly true that if you look at Mexican Americans in different parts of the country, Mexican Americans who live outside of high concentrations of Mexicans, so Mexican Americans who live outside of California and Texas, tend to have more education, tend to have higher earnings, tend to look like they're more successful. The issue is what's causing what there. Is it, you know, that probably reflects the fact that people who got the English proficiency and the education to move out of enclaves, you know, had opportunities to earn more money outside of enclaves, or else their children moved outside of the enclaves. And so I think that reflects more of a selectivity of who migrated rather than the fact that areas outside of enclaves are more hospitable to Mexican-American success.
We've been speaking about your work and the data you've collected about Mexican-Americans. How does that group compare to other groups of Latinos or Hispanics?
Most Hispanic groups look pretty similar to Mexicans. Puerto Ricans look similar, the kind of patterns of progress across generations. Central Americans look similar. Dominicans look similar. The one group that stands out as being different among Hispanic groups is Cubans. And a lot of that has to do with the selectivity of their migration flow. A lot of the immigrants who initially came from Cuba in the 1960s were professionals, doctors, lawyers, highly educated people who were fleeing Castro and the changes that were occurring in Cuba. And so that was a very skilled group, and they've got lots of help from the U.S. government when they arrived. And their children are doing great. You know, second and third generation Cuban Americans have higher education levels than the average white American. But Cubans are kind of the exception among the Latino groups.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Steve Trejo studies economic growth among Mexican Americans. He's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin.